Had nothing to do with the Genesis this morning or with the last song we sang or any of that. And it really has nothing to do with anybody specific. It has to do with everybody. I think everyone will fall into the category. I'm going to start off with a story, and you might have heard it. There was a man and woman, and they got married, and they got along great. They didn't fight. They were open with each other. They confided in each other. They had no secrets from each other. But the woman had made one request of her husband when they got married. She put a shoebox up in the closet on the shelf, and she said, "I do not want you to ever open that to look in it or to ever ask what it's about." And so he agreed. And their life went on, and they got old, and she got sick and had to go to the hospital, and they knew she wasn't going to recover. So she asked her husband to bring that box to the hospital, and so he did. At the hospital, she decided it was time to explain to him what the box was about. She said, "Before I got married to you, my mother told me that every time that I would get mad at you, I should knit a doll." And she said, "Go ahead and open the box." And he did. And a man's eyes teared up because there was only two dolls in that box. And he felt so blessed that she had only been mad at him two times in the whole life. But he had one other question. Because as he looked in the box, he realized there was $95,000 in the box. And he said, "I understand the dolls." But he said, "I don't understand the $95,000. And she said, "That's the money I got from selling the dolls." So, I say that to bring this in, that we all have relationships in our lives that we deal with every day. There's going to be problems that we have to deal with in those relationships. With any relationships, a problem is going to occur. But sometimes we make problems for ourselves by the way we react to others in our relationships. Not so much the way we act at times, but more, I would say, on reaction. And I think we've all heard that. It's not how the problem comes, it's how you take care of a problem. And there's going to be problems come into our lives. So I want to discuss three of these reactions to help not only me, but to help us understand the lesson that I have entitled this morning, "The Trinity of Fear and Sadness." And I'm going to look at three aspects that I think can contribute to how we react to a situation. The first one is isolation, and I've also entitled that independence. And the reason I've entitled it that way is the way we deal with others. When life gets hard, we tend to isolate ourselves from others. We tend to isolate ourselves from those that can help us, those we can learn from, those that might be able to benefit us in whatever situation we're in. We tend to pull back. And when we pull back, we give statements like, "I don't want to bother anyone else with my problem or my situation." Or, "I can take care of myself and I don't need any help." But see, really, it's just the opposite of those statements. When a person makes a statement like that, and I've made the same statements, is they do need help. And they do need people around them. But we tend to pull back, especially if the hurt is very deep. I read a book several years ago. And in that book, the main character's name was Mackenzie. And in that, a very bad thing happened. He was the main character. And a very bad thing took place in his life, and it was an extremely horrible occurrence in his life. And as a result of that in his life, he withdrew from his family and his friends. But he not only withdrew from family and friends, he withdrew from God. So the ones that could come around, the ones that could try to, that knew him the best, were no longer a part of his life. He pulled back into what he called the great darkness. And there was no light in his life. A lot like we discussed this morning, where Jacob said, "I will never leave off mourning my child." Well, Mackenzie didn't. Mackenzie lived in that darkness for years. But being pulled away from God and being pulled away from friends, Mackenzie believed in God but did not really know him because he did not have a relationship with God. And because he didn't have a relationship with God, he wasn't sure of God's love for him or God's love for his family. And he showed that in the book when he accused God of allowing this horrible thing to happen that took place in his life. And because he wasn't sure of God's love, he didn't think God was fair. He thought he was unfair. And because he thought God was unfair, he did not pray to God. He did not talk to God. He did not seek any help from God at all. In Hebrews, the fourth chapter, starting in verse 14, it says, "Since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." The very ones we need, the very ones that know us best, we pull away from them and we isolate ourselves into something a lot of us at times might be able to describe, like Mackenzie did, into the great darkness. A void. Something you feel nobody else can fill. Nobody can help. I'm the only one that can get through this situation. And in actuality, you just made your problem worse because the help that you could be receiving, you won't. So that's the first part, is isolation. The second part is what I call incrimination or judgment. And what I mean by this is that we all, everyone here, are well quite practiced as judges. We're good at it. Amen. We're very good at it. I'm extremely good at it. You want to know? Ask me. And we feel that we are just in our judgments. We feel we know. We judge others on certain criteria. One thing we judge others on is successfulness or quality of life when we have no real idea what's in their life. Look at Luke, the 12th chapter, verse 13. It says, "Some in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.' But he said to him, 'Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?' And he said to them, 'Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions.'" We look at people and we say, that's a very successful person. That's a person that has a good life. And I think sometimes we might even find ourselves envying that life and say, I wish I had that life. I wish I had that car. I wish I had what that person has. But see, that's a judgment. That's a superficial judgment. You don't know what's going on behind that person's life. His whole life or their whole life may be in complete turmoil, but they can hide it. behind a lifestyle that seems perfect. And see, it's a misjudgment to go on that. And because we make judgments like that, it fuels our own feeling of inadequacy, that we don't measure up, because my things aren't as good as that person's things. When in actuality, you might have a better life than the person that has all the money. Solomon said that a person sleeps better at night if they don't have money. He also said the one who has a lot of money doesn't get good sleep because he's worried about someone taking his money. See, I don't have that worry. You can break into my account and look at it, and you'll probably donate to the cause. So we don't need to make judgments like that. Look also at Hebrews 11:37. These are ones that were counted unworthy by people. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. That's who God considered had a good life. And we would look at them and we would consider them afflicted and stricken and would not desire their life. But their home's heaven. Superficial judgment. We also judge according to body language, the way a person moves, the way a person takes something that we said. And we judge what's in their mind by the facial expression or the way they handle themselves, their demeanor. And we decide, okay, that didn't go over good. And sometimes that may be absolutely correct. But there's only one real way to know, is to ask. If I get a real bad look, sometimes I'll say, okay, maybe I said that wrong. And I'll say it out loud, to find out. Because I do have times where I say things that come off really wrong. They're really right up here, but when they come out here, somehow they get all jumbled up. So I ask. But a lot of times people will make that judgment and go away and start thinking something about a person they should not be thinking. And it lends to this type of attitude where we feel, okay, well, that person doesn't like me. When in actuality, they might a whole lot. And so you avoid them. Well, that adds back to the isolation and adds back to the problem in a relationship. We judge motivations on the way someone does something. Well, he didn't really have his heart in that, I could tell. Just the way they went about and did the job, they didn't have their heart in it. You don't know. That man may have had, or that woman may have had, a million things on their mind, and they were performing at that time at peak capacity. Or a waitress comes out, and she's not really attentive to you or to your needs at the restaurant, but you don't know what problems she's went through during the day. But we make judgments that they were not attentive to us, that they were not doing their job good. And that's where you can make that judgment and say, well, I'm going to go talk to the manager about this, that she's just not the waitress we should have here, when you know nothing about what's going on with her. We also make judgments on occupation. How many politicians from Washington do you know personally on a first name basis? Unanimous. I don't either. But we make judgments according to their character, don't we? You can make judgments according to a statement made by a person and say that was not a good statement to make. But to take the statement farther and to judge the whole person's character by the statement is a fallacy. You don't know the person. You know nothing about the person. You don't know if he had been led into making that bad statement or how he was led into it or anything else. We make assumptions about Hollywood movie stars, don't we? I've even heard it in sermons. That's like walking into the devil's den. Same thing. How many people here know on a first name basis a movie star? Because see, if you don't, you don't know anything about them. But we make that judgment, and we feel righteous in that judgment because it makes us feel better. I am not like that person. I don't do things like that. I give my money to God. I go to church. I go to class. I am not like that tax collector, that politician, that movie star. I'm not like any of those, God. Sound familiar? When in actuality, he should not have been judging the man who was the tax collector and fell on his face, beat his chest, and wouldn't even look to heaven and truly talk to God. But he felt quite righteous in his judgment. We also make judgments on eternal destiny. We feel because the person didn't measure up to what we see in them right now, that their destiny cannot be heaven. Or, from what we see in them right now, their only destiny can be hell. That's not our judgment. That's God's judgment. They're not going to stand before the judgment seat of David Huff. They're not going to stand before that judgment seat. They're going to stand before God's judgment seat. He'll decide. That's one judgment we should stay as far away from as we can. Another one, and I'll give you some that go along with that last one, is like those who steal ID, stolen ID, where your bank account's emptied, or con artists. We're ready to condemn those, or terrorists, or dictators, or murderers. Did you know some like this is who Paul converted? Or those who kidnap and kill children? Like I said, my first reaction to a lot of things like that's anger. And that would be a lot of judgments some people would make. And you would judge these people unworthy of eternal life. You would judge these people unworthy of coming to God. The only thing you would consider them worthy of is death. And before God, that's where each and every one of us stood before we became his child, worthy of death. But he considered it the right thing to do to give us a way out from that death. Remember the Amish a few years ago? This man went into their school, killed children. And I'm sure some of them felt anger, and I'm sure some of them felt betrayal. But the outward pouring was to this man's family. They were sorry that this had to happen to them. Not to the Amish, but to the man's family who did the killing. Their concern was for others outside of that, even though they were grieving, I know, heartily in their own hearts. They did not deem the man worthy of death. They deemed the man a sinner that needed God. That's what they deemed it. And we tend to have a judgment about other brethren. Brethren you may not even know. Brethren you have not even met. Brethren that you know nothing about. And I'm going to say this next statement as kindly as I can. But we make those statements on churches we know nothing about, but we'll call them a name and we will label them unworthy of any knowledge or any time of our presence to be around them. We've deemed them unworthy of God's grace. We've deemed them in sin when we have never been to the building, we have never met anyone in the building, and we know nothing about what they do. But that's just been the way they've been spoken about in the community. I will guarantee you this. There'll be some of those standing beside you, or maybe not. They may be up there and you may not. See, those judgments we need to stay out of. Unless you know the person personally, you have no judgment to make on that, whether as an individual or whether as a group. But I've heard it said, not here, but I've heard it said in the past, well, I know they're not right. Just look at the building. And because they had a big building or an ornate building, they've been judged now unworthy of God's grace. Or they stand outside of it. Look at John 7:24. Is that where I'm at? No, I lost it somewhere. Did I miss one? I missed one. Oh, okay. I lost it. Tim's going like this, and I'm going where? Do not judge by appearances, but judge with righteous judgment. Also in Romans 14, it says, why do you pass judgment on your brother? Or you, why do you despise your brother? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then each of us will give an account of himself to God. Therefore, let us not pass judgment on one another any longer, but rather decide never to put a stumbling block or hindrance in the way of my brother. See, our criteria that we base our judgments on are superficial. And we do it sometimes, not all the time, and it may be none of the time for you, but sometimes it's to make us feel superior to the one we're judging. Just like the tax collector. The one man felt very superior to him, because he didn't do any of those things. And most judgments are from our own self-centered thoughts. And we weigh it against the things that have raised us, the things that have brought us up, and we use that to make the judgment. But we need to make judgments on what we only know for a fact. If you see something you think it may need to look into far, look into it. But get the facts before you judge. That goes for anybody, and especially brethren. Let us do good unto all men, especially the household of faith. And that's one way we can do good. And we also judge God. We stand in judgment of the Almighty anytime we consider God has failed, God is unfair, God can't be trusted, God cannot help. When we say those things, we've called God into judgment. We're saying, you, God, are not able to do this. Dangerous judgment. Look at Job 1:20 through 22. This is after he's been told everything's been ripped away from him, and he's had several come and said, and only I have survived to tell you. It says, then Job arose and tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Do you understand? It's a sin to make these statements about God. Because they're false, they're lies. God can help. God has not failed. God is not unfair, and God can be trusted. To say the opposite is a lie, and a lie is sin, and we know that eternal life is not in any liar. You need to think carefully when you take words like that about God and use them. Thirdly, imagination. And I guess this is the worst culprit of all. This has been my worst enemy when it comes to fearing something, okay, that something's going to happen or whatever. There was a book by Charles Dickinson. It's called A Tale of Two Cities, and you might have seen it on Star Trek, because when Spock gave Kirk the book, he opened it up and it said, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And Kirk looked at him and said, are you trying to tell me something? But it is a very true statement. In our lives, you look back and you've had the best of times and you've had the worst of times. And that's a lot what the book was about. But a lot of times in life, we can take something that's best and turn it into the worst. Have you ever had a situation, say at work, where something didn't go real good or management's upset and you go home? Have you ever played scenarios over in your head about how the next day's going to go? If the boss is going to be very upset, if they're going to call you into the office, and before the night's over, you pretty well fired yourself, okay? And you go in the next day and nothing happens. But we make the worst of it when it could have been the best. Sometimes we make too many judgments along that line. I can't remember the man that said it. It might have been, I can't remember his name, but he said, of all the fears I've had in my life, he said 99% of them never came true. And isn't that true when you think back about the things you've imagined? Do you ever take them to a tally sheet and say how many of these actually came true? I tend to agree with the 99% that it doesn't come true. But we not only do that to ourselves, we do that with others. Look at 1 Corinthians 13 chapter. It says, love is patient and kind. And because love is patient and kind, love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful, and it does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things. Love believes all things. Hopes all things, endures all things, love never ends. But a lot of times we look at others and we think the worst instead of the best. They may have done something, they may have come out of somewhere, they may have said something, and immediately we think the worst of them. Well, they said this to me because. Did you ever say that? I've said it, and I tried to catch myself in the later years and say, I should not have said that. If you want to know why someone said or did something, a good thing to do is to go ask the person if it's really bothering you, why they did that, why'd you do that? And then you might solve a whole lot of problems. Because, see, once you think that, if you think the worst of it, you carry it around with you, don't you? And you play it over and over and over. And you get to play that over and over and over with the fears of bosses and everything else. So now we got all kinds of things going on. We got people that don't like us. We got people that hate us. We got people doing things to us, and I know why they're doing it. And I got a boss that's fixing to fire me in the morning. Have a good night. And we wonder why we lay down. I just don't know why I couldn't sleep last night. And it's because of that. And along with the situations is the best and worst of a future. Especially if you've lost a job or something, the only thing you can see is they're coming to take my house, they're coming to take my car, I have no money, I'm going to be living under the 57th Street Bridge here in the next month. Anyone ever had that happen to them? But we've thought it. I thought it about my restaurant. We, at one point, made a very bad business decision. And one thing about being boss is you get to bear the full brunt of any bad decisions. And a lot of times there's no one else there with you. And I saw the business being taken. This was in about 2.5 years into business, I saw the business gone. The business was going to dissolve. This company was going to do us in. We're going to be in extreme debt. We'll lose the house. And it got to such a point, I went and talked to an attorney about chapter 13. I had played it that far. Didn't happen. Okay, it was a bad decision. Did cost us some money. But it did not kill us. But the future, a lot of times, unsure, and the future scares us, doesn't it? Who here wants to go to heaven? Good, I got everybody's hand. Some too. But we're scared to pass from this life to get there, aren't we? Because we're not sure. We're not sure of that passage to get there. Or what's going to take place. Even though we have the Bible, I am convinced that is the briefest of all descriptions of what's going to happen. So we can understand. But it scares us to transition that. The future scares us here. And the rationalization of God's judgment a lot of times doesn't come in when we are faced with our own mortality, does it? And that fear really sets in. Or if you're a friend of a person who is mortally ill, the fear can set in for you too. I've tried to think on different things when I go to the person's room and I know they're going to die. One thing I ask them, because I believe my own grandparents and one of my parents to be in heaven and then some friends that I have are also there, I ask them to say hi when they arrive. And let them know I'm still on track. Because there was one man, I can't remember who it was. Again, bad with names. Kevin's good at names. But the man had lived a good, long life. I think it was Bill Gaither that said it, or one of his people. And they had this friend that was mortally ill and was going to die, and they said, when you get to heaven, tell all my friends that I'm still a Christian and haven't died and went to the other place. Because he'd been on earth so long, he thought they were missing him. So we need to look at the passing not so badly. Polycarp was an elder at a church in Smyrna, and that's the same church that's in the Bible. When they burned him to death at the stake, one of the people there said, I did not witness the dying of a Christian. He said, I witnessed his birth into heaven. And I think that's the way we should look at things like that. We also have things in our imagination like we talked about this morning, revenge. Look at Proverbs 23, verse 7, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Matthew 5, 28, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman and is lustful in intent has already committed adultery in her heart. Now, why would I put those two together? Because verse 28 to me is not just a very specific verse for a very specific incident to cover only one specific thing. The key to that verse is it's talking about what goes on in your mind. So in your mind, if you undress a woman and if you have relations with that woman, it says that you have committed sin. See, a lot of times we'll do things in our mind because it has no external consequences. But it does have eternal consequences on your soul. So if you think of someone, let's say a murderer, and you're personally knowing who he killed, and in your mind you imagine you taking his life, I can't draw any other conclusion eternally that you're going to be judged as a murderer. Because in your mind, with lustful intent, you killed the person. You beat the person. You've taken the person's money away. You've damaged the person's life to where they'll have to go begging for food. And see, a lot of us don't draw the conclusion that that's sin. But I fully believe, because of Matthew 5:28, it will fully condemn us as well as any sin. Because it's what's working up in here. If you imagine adultery in your mind, you're guilty of it. If you imagine murder in your mind, you're guilty of it. If you imagine heinous acts of any kind in your mind, you're guilty of that. And I'm not talking about a fleeting thought. I'm talking about where you dwell on it, where you plan it, where you carry it out, where you execute it. That's what I'm talking about. The imagination is something that can get a lot of us condemned. In Hebrews 10 and verse 30, it says, "For we know him who said, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay again. The Lord will judge his people.' Let all these judgments be God's judgments, not ours. Let us not condemn ourselves through our own fallacies of judgment. To conclude it, imagination can produce emotions of fear and sadness. Superficial and self-centered judgments cause us not to trust others. And because we are hurting emotionally and we don't trust others, we isolate ourselves into the darkness of our minds." And I've been there. Okay, and it's not a pleasant place. And it's a very hard place to get out of. I want to offer these remedies that can help us in this, and then the lesson will be yours. Instead of isolation, we need to have a community of relationships. When things go bad, think of the person who might best be able to help you. Seek that person's advice. Go to them. Or if you know someone that has gone through the same situation you're going through, maybe they learned something going through it that they can impart to you that'll make your path a little easier. Secondly, instead of judgment, we need to live life with simplicity. Let us try living with the mind of an adult looking through the eyes of a child. It's kind of like what the Bible says, to be as meek as sheep, but wise. See, have the mind of an adult to know when you should avoid something, when this is not going to be good for me, from the things that you have learned, from experiences, from the Bible, from the teachings. But then look at everybody you come in contact with and judge each motive and situation through the eyes of a child. Because children don't see bad things in people. They see good. And they trust. A child's trust. If you can ever develop a child's trust, you've got it made. Look at a child when Christmas is coming. You ever seen a child about this tall ever believe that Santa Claus was not coming? And if you told them, no, Santa's coming, no, he's coming. The trust was complete until it was proven otherwise. And that's how we should treat each other. I think the best of you, unless something just slaps me in the face and changes that, but I don't need to hold it, I don't need to isolate it, I don't need to make judgments with it, I need to come to you about it. That's what I need to do with it. And that will help us. Let us love large, be quick to forgive, and even quicker to ask for forgiveness. I know those are cliches, but they're very fitting. See, if you live life with the mind of an adult through the eyes of a child, and you love greatly, and you forgive greatly, and you ask forgiveness speedily, your life will be a lot happier because you won't be carrying grudges, you won't be holding resentments, you won't be looking for revenge, and you won't be trying to find problems that aren't there. You know why? Because we need to do the same thing with God. We need to trust Him completely. Let me give you this statement about that when you're thinking about revenge and all these other bad things. The cross is where mercy triumphed over justice. Let us then be more willing to go to the cross for others than to the judgment seat. Be willing to sacrifice instead of judge. Be like the man who saw the man on the side of the road, the Samaritan, and took him up, bound him up, put oil on his wounds, took him to the inn and said, whatever more he needs, when I come back, I'll pay. Let us look for the positive in others and not the negative. And instead of imagination, which fuels fear and sadness and hate, let's imagine joy, love, kindness, and make it revolve around you. Surround yourself in it. There will be days when sadness comes. People will pass, relationships will end, and sadness will come into our lives. But don't give them the fuel of the Trinity that makes them strong. Deny them that. Deny them that Trinity of isolation, of imagination, and incrimination. And they'll die. And they'll go away. And I'm not saying this, that this is a fix-all for everybody. I know some people have medical, and it's been preached from the pulpit for years that if you just do these things from the Bible, you'd never need any medicine. I totally disagree with that, because there's chemically things that can go wrong with a person's body, and it can cause things to happen totally out of their control. But I do know this. These things will help, even in that situation. Medication plus God can also work. And I think that's a message we need to understand. I'm thankful you sat there and listened to me for so long. And I want to thank you all for that. If you're here and you have not become a child of God, that is one thing that can lend to sadness and fear, is understanding that you're not right with God and understanding that you have sin in your life. But you can remedy that this morning through God's plan, through baptism. And when you rise from those waters, you will be free from that sin. And you know your relationship will be right with God, and you can be like the Ethiopian eunuch, and you can go away rejoicing. You can go away happy. And you can sleep good, knowing that God is with you, that God aids you, and God will help you, and God is someone you can always trust. If that's your situation this morning, and you do want to remedy it, why don't you come now as we all stand and sing?